Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about Star Frontiers, the sci-fi RPG from the makers of D&D in the 1980s. I'm still running it today, so we're going to hash out what works great, what needs some tweaks and fixes to keep it fresh in 2026 and beyond. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into today's discussion, I'll remind everyone, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host on our private Discord server, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. You'll get an invite to the Discord server, and once you have that account all set up and ready to go, maybe about 10 minutes after the end of this show, we will be there to live video chat with all of our patrons. So, love to see you there.
We have the best patrons. We look forward to doing that every day. So, for example, our patron Bacrius is checking in that we're currently live on Twitch and YouTube and Restream. So thank you so much for that. Paul, I've been, you know, so I'm going to, I wanted to share my joy today. And so I apologize if I...
I got to ask, though, in the intro, you said still running. Is it still going on? I thought it was over.
Okay, that's a little poetic. Yeah, you're right. So I did wrap our the Star Frontiers campaign that I had been running, to my surprise, for about 2 years, and we did wrap it two Fridays ago. So it was January 2nd that we did finally wrap it. So I've been running it this year. I've been running it in the year of our Lord 2026. So that's a technically true statement. So I don't think I was planning on a 2-year campaign when I started. I think when back in early 2024, when I started that, the idea was our customary bi-weekly gaming group was like, we were kind of having a gap in the schedule of what people wanted to run. And I was like, you know what? I enjoy Star Frontiers so much. I'm going to grab that. I'm going to grab the pre-made adventure in the box. It's going to be a turnkey solution. It's going to be very low effort on my part. It's going to last for a couple months. Those things were not correct at all. And so I've completely re-architected the whole campaign and a large part of the rule set. And it wound up going 2 years. And if you've seen our companion show that I was running at the time, Dan's Old School Minis on the Wandering DMs channel, you'll notice that I personally recast all the miniatures and repainted all of them in order to have stuff on the table. So that was, I got to dug into it a lot more deeply than I first expected. I'm so happy I got that opportunity, frankly.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Dan, before we get into the details of your most recent run, I guess I need to ask, because what's your history here? Because I'd never heard of Star Frontiers until you told me you were running. Like, what?
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, like in the last couple of years, really?
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. Great. So it is from makers of Dungeons and Dragons, and TSR came out with D&D in the 1970s, and they had some other role playing games. I kind of want to say that their next real big splash, I kind of want to say, was this game. And in 1983, they published this sci-fi game called Star Frontiers. And I think on the back of the box, it'll say from the makers of Dungeons and Dragons. And this was when, of course, Star Wars was a big splash. So I think you'd had the first two movies out at this point. And of course, they wanted to kind of get into that. You know, you got the classic fantasy D&D, you got the science fiction here. People know it's not the first sci-fi game ever. That would be Traveller, possibly something else. But yeah, I'll confess, I was kind of a TSR zombie. I got their promotional materials. I saw this. I was excited. I know I wasn't I had just become a teenager, so I was excited about this. I got it in 1983, started running it, and I ran this whole same campaign back when we were 13, 14 years old.
All right. So this is your second full run of that adventure?
It is. It absolutely is.
Did that earlier run also take 2 years to complete?
That's a good question. Jeez, I don't know. I don't know. It must have been on that order. It must have been on that order. Now, we might have been getting together more often, possibly. We might have been playing, at school more frequently. So maybe it didn't take as long. But that's a great question. I don't remember at all. Wow.
Yeah.
Time is meaningless.
I'm just wondering where this crazy concept entered your head that you would only spend a couple of months at it. Or maybe you just assume that people would tire of it and you would move on to something else.
I mean, I'm looking at, so the interesting thing is, it was such a great publishing idea. And mostly the adventures that come with it were written by Tom Oldvey and Mark Akers. And so one of the things they did was that in the boxed set, and I don't know too many role-playing games that did this, in the box set, you get this initial adventure, which has the code SF0, and it's only the start of a trilogy. So it whets your appetite. And if you play through this, like, oh, you want more of this? Well, it's, part two, you got to go actually get in the store and go buy that. Yep, so if you put all three of the, which of course I did, at the time, these things were fairly hard to get to. You've had to physically get to a store and actually buy a paper book. And you had to wait months for the next one to come out. And if you add it all up together, so the first booklet here I see is 30 pages. I guess they didn't count the first two. I mean, that's only 90 pages of content all told. So I don't know if they expected you to go through one of these in 4 or 5 sessions, and it would add up to a total of maybe 15 sessions or so. But once again, I misestimated how long it would take, and it wound up taking about 21 months. Yep.
Now, my confusion aside, like I feel like my having not heard of it is maybe less, not so surprising when you consider also that none of your players had ever heard of it either, correct?
That is true. That is actually correct. And some of them went and looked it up online, and I had to caution them about some of the stuff that came out later with the same title, of course. Mm-hmm. But what I was running was right out of the box, 1983, no supplements, no add-ons or changes that came later. So you're right. That was one of the nice things. And as I've said a couple times on the show, One of the wonderful surprises that I stumbled into was because the rules aren't available, because you can't buy them anywhere, I didn't have the capacity to give the rules to my players, and we had to just discover the rules through play. They didn't know exactly how things worked or what pieces of equipment or what skills did, and they just had to try it out in the game and kind of explore this play space. And boy, that was a wonderful facet to the play that I'd forgotten about when I first started playing D&D, and just nobody knew what the parameters were, and that itself was really part of the excitement and part of the danger. And us stumbling into that rediscovery really kind of re-illuminated a bunch of stuff for role playing to me, that they were willing to play with that, they were willing to be flexible in that way, and found it interesting to explore this. Occasionally some debates. Yes, we've had debates about exactly how likely it is to shoot somebody with a gun from 20 feet away. and I don't mind that. I don't mind digging into that and seeing, is this something we need to adjust, or is it something that is reasonable in the world? And that was all a parallel to the in-campaign diegetic stuff. That was a really exciting component to rediscover.
Interesting. I mean, because I feel like, I'm curious how that's different in this case versus, say, I don't know, most recently I've been running Quest. and right. all of those players are learning. They never played Quest before. They're learning it as they go. But so am I, honestly. I've mm-hmm. played in one or two games of it. I want to say I've read the book. Let's say I've skimmed through the book, right? So I kind of know how things work. There are plenty of cases where I'm also like, how does this work? Oh, I don't know. I gotta hang on. Let me dig through the book. I don't remember. Or I'll make something up. I suppose it's different in this case because you have run it before in your past a long time ago. You feel like a lot. Had you retained a lot of the knowledge from your teenage years of how to run the game?
I want to say about half. I was surprised by how murky I was and how many things popped up that I had to look up later and get surprised that I had not remembered them. And I think that some of it was the proud nails of the system, the things that maybe weren't the best design choices or things that I've gotten away from in my gaming. So there was a rather surprising amount that I did actually stumble over and say, I'm going to have to look this up later. And I did wind up, it was an opportunity to think about whether we like the rules. So I actually wound up with one-page sheet of just reminders. This is stuff that I'd forgotten. And I had to have, this is the first page in my loose leaf binder that I'd look at every single night of, here are the rules that I tend to forget. That are hard for me to remember. So I needed that. And then on top of that, I wound up at the end with a 2-page sheet of house rules. So these are the things that I didn't like that we modified, which is not that much. I mean, this looks kind of ridiculous, but actually it's not that much compared to the house rules that some of us will come up with for D&D that are like pages and pages and pages long. In some places I was surprised by the fact that I didn't remember it so well.
So did you've got these loose pages of notes. I guess, like, what materials existed for you? Obviously, you have the box set, which has got the rule book. It's got and I saw that you recast the minis. You've got, do you have a DM screen? Is there a screen for this, Dan? Did you have to make one? Did you not use one? Yeah.
This is so useful. This is certainly the number one utility that they published for it. Just the exact same thing they published in 1983. It's really well designed. Mostly on the outside, you've got like equipment lists that the player characters can possibly choose from, skill lists, stuff like that. And then on the inside, you've got all the combat tables that the referee needs to run it. And it's pretty much exactly what I need. So I did have this on the table.
Minus the one page of notes.
Minus the one page of notes, correct. And I will also say that, so when I was introducing players, and we'd had new players come in once in a while, I wound up with an elevator pitch. And my elevator pitch for Star Frontiers was it's a 1980s science fiction role-playing game in a part of space called the Frontier. And the game is something like a mashup of Star Wars, Foundation, Dune, and Starship Troopers. And then if they didn't know what percentile dice were, I would give them a primer on using the percentile dice, because the game is all entirely decimal, just uses percentile dice or D10s for damage. That's it. Now, my players would hear me say that, and then they'd look at the artwork, because this is the main piece of artwork that they had on their eyeballs to introduce the game all the time. And they'd say, well, that's just the Star Wars cantina. That's just precisely the vibe from the Star Wars cantina. This game is basically just Star Wars. One of the four character races are, kind of Wookiee-ish, pretty much. And I can see why they would get that. They would get that sensibility, frankly.
Were they right though, or where does it diverge from Star Wars? Where is it very different?
They never changed from that opinion. And so 2 years later, I'm pretty sure they would still say, "Yeah, it's pretty much Star Wars, more or less." I mean, you know, I would you know, I would try to defend that and they go, can I get a lightsaber? I go, no, no, there are no laser swords in this game. Yeah. Instead, we have sonic swords. That's the best weapon. If you can possibly get a sonic-based sword, that is the primary apex weapon in the game. You kind of want that. Okay. But no, 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 okay. No. No lightsabers in this game, so it's clearly not Star Wars.
Oh, God. Oh gosh. Are there space wizards in Star Frontiers?
Okay. No. Flat out no. In the basic game, I think there was a later accessory that added psionics or something like that. But again, we don't play with that. So out of the main book. So I feel that the rule book to me talks foundation, talks like 30s pulp science fiction, like Asimov, that kind of stuff. I think that the conversation about like how does interstellar travel work through basically hyperspace, I think that they're basically pulling that out of Foundation more or less. So that's on my mind a lot of the time, but I'll confess that doesn't seem to come through on the player side for what it's worth. It's definitely not Star Trek. Notice that that was not in my list. It's definitely not Star Trek. It's clearly, you know, it's kind of gritty. It's more gritty, junky, punky, you know, it is a violent place, frankly. It's not a we're all working together at the UN type situation.
Yeah, I mean, I get that from the artwork here. Let me put the cover back up here. I mean, lovely piece of Elmore work here. Very, very.
Yeah, right.
Sort of typical early 80s Elmore here. You've clearly got a crash landing. You've got, you know, three adventurers with weapons drawn. The weapons are various. Their gear is, you know, definitely non-standard, right? It's all different. It looks like hodgepodged collections of whatever equipment they could get their hands on. And just their stances, right? They look like they're ready to rock. They have no idea. They're expecting some form of violent altercation immediately. But that's a pretty different vibe from Star Trek.
Yeah, right. And I'll also say, so that piece of artwork depicts the beginning of the campaign. So that's clearly a very literal depiction of the beginning of this campaign. We've talked about a couple times here, set on this brand newly discovered world called Volturnus, planet of mystery. And the backstory is the planetary government discovered this new place. Maybe it's got possible resources you could use. They sent a team in of really high-end professional super agents, and they were lost. And the government has now had budget cuts. They can't afford another elite team. So they picked up your scrappy band of barely trained newbies, and they've sent you as the follow-up to try to find Team A. And then it turns out that before anybody even got there, the planet's already been infested by interstellar pirates. They attack the ship coming in, and then you have to get on a lifeboat and you crash on a rocky outcrop in a giant desert, and all of your equipment all gets burned up and you lose everything and you have to start from scratch, from nothing. I'll also point out that, again, part of the vibe here is the whole first third here of the campaign is trying to survive in this giant barren desert. And of course that also kind of conjures up Tatooine in Star Wars. Remember, Tatooine has two suns. Does Volturnus? No. Volturnus has two moons, as you can see in the artwork there. They're totally different.
Absolutely different. Just like sonic swords and light swords are radically. Oh boy. Does this adventure ever leave planet side? Do you get into spaceships? Do you have space dogfights? Nope, none of that.
The campaign does not. And as a what a great question. And as a side point, I'll say in 1983 the whole rule system didn't have anything about space combat or encounters. asserted a campaign area with 40 different worlds, and clearly we can travel between worlds, but it doesn't say how. And so when I was, so I was 13 at the time, and this drove me nuts. I was like, where's the space combat X-Wings, Star Destroyer? Where's this stuff for me? And yep, the response from the company is, well, we'll come out with that. You know, we trust Tom Moldvay. He's our, or Doug Niles wound up finally doing it. You know, Doug Niles, who also did Battle System in the 80s, he's the TSR war game guy. We trust that Doug Niles will come up with something, and that will be published maybe next year. Now, I got to tell you, there's been two things in my life that have been the hardest to wait for, and that was the gap in the Star Wars movies between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, when they left on a cliffhanger about we've lost Han Solo. Is it true that Darth Vader is Luke's father? I didn't believe it for like 2 years until Return of the Jedi came out. I've got to find out. It was so hard to wait. And the second thing was waiting for the two box sets of Star Frontiers for the spaceship part to come out. I was being driven nuts for a year. And I don't think there's any game, but the day that the spaceship version of Star Frontiers came out, I went to the game store that day. I got the box set that day. And as soon as I got into the car, I was ripping the plastic off to get into that sucker. I have never anticipated anything so much as that. So the version that we're playing in the campaign, absolutely no spaceship stuff. It's all off stage. And I don't, you know what? It was kind of nice. It's the whole 2 year campaign was bookended with scenario one, you're crashing in a fiery crash onto the planet. Bam, can you survive? And then 2 years later, the very last thing that happened was you're pulled off the planet and finally rescued when you win. So that was actually kind of a nice arc to it, frankly.
I mean, it sounds like a great story, and I do like the idea that the adventure is focused, right? Because it is easy, I think, with these kind of grandiose space opera games that, you know, you get some of everything, and that can make it feel very disjointed or, you know, just incoherent.
Right.
Wait, I guess I would just want to go back to young Dan in the car ripping the plastic excitedly off of the box set for Space Combat. Did it live up to the hype? Was it good?
You know, I like it a lot. I like it. Yeah, and that set is called Nighthawks. It's called Star Frontiers Nighthawks. I like it quite a bit. I'll say this. It took me a long time to see what the problems were. It's good enough that it took me a surprisingly long time to find the problems.
I was prepared for you to tell me that you wanted to run the original campaign because it doesn't have that problematic part of it or that letdown of a part in it. Was that any of your drive to like be like, great, don't worry about space combat in this adventure?
Interesting question. Again, at the outset, I was like, well, this is just going to be easy for me as a turnkey solution. I will say, and you know, this goes for a whole bunch of other role-playing games, is that you and I have thought about the difficulties of combining, you know, basically you have a war game at that point, of interfacing your small scale inhabiting a particular player character play versus we're all on a ship, which could be a D&D sailing ship, or it could be a Star Frontier spaceship. And there's only one single piece on the board and it's all the players all together. And one single shot can wipe out the whole party. And nobody's really going to be happy about that. So it is true that if I do think about moving to the we're a team on one ship and we get into a combat, I actually don't mind avoiding that. But it wasn't something I thought about picking this particular campaign. It is true that it's kind of a convenience.
Yeah, and I think there's something nice too. Again, I like the focus of it. I've certainly run plenty of games where I chew up a good, I don't know, hour of the first 4 hour session or even two of just like setting up the setting and getting the players to where the adventure is. Right.
Yeah.
So I kind of adore this idea that like it just starts with like, and you crash land You're here and you've crash landed. Go.
I'll say this. Okay. And I don't know if they plan this. I do not know if the writers plan this or if it's just a really happy accident, that it works really well to the way that it's set up in that way. It works really well to discover the rules as you get little extra bits of resources in your party. So now technically there is a prelude. There is an encounter on the incoming spaceship. So the very first thing is you jump into the new solar system and your transit vessel gets attacked by pirates. Now at this point, you're just asleep in your bedrooms. You don't have any equipment with you. You don't have any armor. All your gear is over in the locker room, and all of your weapons are in a locked weapons case in the captain's cabin. So you have literally nothing. And so a pirate bursts into your cabin with a club and like shot gloves. And the only opportunity the party has is you have to fist fight them with nothing else. So the first thing that happens is you learn how does fist fighting work. And everybody's on the same level, and you're just punching. And then, assuming you win that, you take the club and you take the shot gloves. And now we get to learn how do melee weapons work. And then the next thing, now someone's got a machine gun, got an automatic pistol and a grenade, right? And you have to, hopefully you can beat them up and take that away, right? And then you learn about how do powered weapons and how do bullet weapons work. And so you do wind up doing this kind of introductory cycle that, you know, a lot of video games would conscientiously create, and you wind up learning about the rules as you learn about the resources. And then you crash land and you have to start gathering stuff where you can. And it works remarkably well to go through that kind of on-ramp to the game. It's That's really lovely.
You know, it reminds me. Reminds me a lot of the large black box basic D&D set that came out in the early 90s. The big
one.
I talked about that one a couple times in this show. That actually has an intro adventure where your party wakes up in prison, right? Your evil megalomaniac wizard has taken you prisoner and shoved you in his dungeon. You wake up in prison. You have nothing. And so again, similarly, like it's literally room by room as you're making your way out of the dungeon. Like, oh, now we're going to learn about melee combat because that's all you can possibly do. And oh, this room you find a bow. Okay, I guess now we can use bows. And this, you know, now you found his library. There's some scrolls here. Now we can learn about magic. The interesting thing is the game is very explicitly set up as this is tutorial mode.
I know, right?
Even to the level of the expectation is your character sheet is basically blank. So there's a room where you discover, like, there are different races. Which race are you? Like, oh, I got to write that in. I got to write that in my character sheet.
Which
is a little weird and feels a little ham-fisted, but I don't know. I guess it's clever.
I think that's not the case here.
The players made character sheets and made characters for this, or do you just, like, you're you. You wake up on a spaceship attacked by pirates. Go.
So, great question, and this is an interesting point. And now I will say that none of the books explicitly say that we've designed this adventure as a tutorial. They never say that. So it's a big question mark in my head whether that was a conscious choice or totally accidental. Now, there's a couple places where the rule book is disconnected from the adventures. And one of the ways that there's this thematic disconnect, I don't know, Paul, if you want to pull up a couple of the images that I have. So I have pictures of like the stuff in the rule books and the maps and stuff like that. So the
talking about this? I'm not sure.
Yeah, exactly. So the game rules are set up to be very tactical. Okay, so nowadays you'd say miniatures battle maps. Well, you couldn't depend on that. So the boxed set comes with this huge number of game counters that you can see in that image on the bottom right. And so all the PC races and all the alien races and all the robots and all the stuff that's going to appear in this campaign, they have several sheets of counters for. and then all of the encounter areas, like the first spaceship fight that I'm talking about on the top there, have pre-made battle maps in the same scale. And the counters are like half an inch big. So the spaces on those maps are only half an inch big. And they have all this kind of pre-made tactical stuff pre-made. And again, one of the really clever publishing points is that all the battle maps for this entire three module set are in the boxed set. So when you open the box set, you basically have this like teaser material of like, oh, what's this battle map for? What's this? You don't know. What are the contents? You're going to have to buy the future module to find out what's in this space, which is super, super clever to a 13-year-old such as myself. Now, if you move, there's a single map that's like mostly purple in color. Can you pull that up?
Yep.
Okay. So this is the basic setting for the Star Frontiers game. It's the giant science fiction city on the biggest planet that's the capital of the frontier sector. And so my point with this is that the rule book is set up thinking about a big advanced urban environment. And there's a big city and there's a bunch of skyscrapers and they talk about businesses and there's really extensive rules for vehicles. Skimmers like Star Frontiers, like Star Wars, you know, what do they call them in Star Wars? The hover, whatever's,
I'm forgetting what they call them
in Star Wars now, but we call them hover cars or skimmers. So ground cars and motorcycles and jet copters and air jets and gliders and all this kind of stuff, and really extensive rules for vehicle combat. And they talk about, well, what's going to happen in the game is every session, you're going to get a mission from some kind of operator. They're going to offer you a particular amount of money. And then you can go to the equipment list, right? And you can buy all this different equipment. And then you'll come back and you'll get your reward. And maybe you'll need to heal up in the hospital. And you can buy a robot. And you can use your programming skills and all that kind of stuff. And but this adventure just disposes with all of that, is you get dumped on this wilderness planet, you're totally out of contact, you don't have any radio, and none of that is appropriate. You're never in a big city, you never have a vehicle, like a ground car or a hover, there's no place to go to recharge your weapons or buy stuff off a list, or there's no hospitals, none of that is appropriate in this lost wilderness fight for survival campaign that Volturnus is. What's up with that?
I mean, this map that we're looking at is basically never used. It's never used in the whole thing.
Absolutely. No. It's not on the planet of Volturnus. Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
Absolutely the case. Right?
That is so odd. I want to know what was the meeting where they decided to spend the money to print this giant map that they're going to fold up and put in a box set that is utterly unused. That's so odd.
It just feels like there was a team making the rules and there was a team making the adventures, and they just went off in totally different directions is what it feels like. And on that point, right, so you were asking like what was on the character sheet to begin with. So I have a basic character sheet, and of course the rule book has a whole set of, 12 steps of generation, including pick your race, roll your abilities, pick your skills. Are you skilled in lasers? Are you skilled in throwing grenades? Are you skilled in melee weapons? Or are you a doctor? Or do you know martial arts? And then take this money, go to your equipment list, and buy whatever weapon, or you can buy, if you have a lot of money, you can buy a robot and stuff like that. Okay. Now, I think a problem that I ran into when I was 13 is you'll spend an hour or two with a bunch of people kitting out, equipping your character like you'll do in D&D, and then notice that the very first thing that happens is you start the adventure, and all of that gets taken away from you. It's all removed, locked up, and then destroyed, and it's all just wiped out. And of course, players are going to be legitimately irritated. They spent all that time thinking about that. So this time, I at least knew about that. And I said, look, you've been equipped with what you need. We'll get to that later. And I just said, you've got whatever skills you picked, you've got tech kits, you've got med kits, you've got weapons. And in fact, they gave you armor. They gave you body armor. They gave you an advanced combat truck, right? And I'll just give you the details of all that when you get on the ground. And of course, our players were like, oh, this is so wonderful. This never happens in Dan's games. Oh man, we have all this equipment. And they unfortunately started jotting it down as I was just kind of riffing on it. And even though I avoided the careful equip your character part, and I was kind of patting myself on the back for that, 2 years later, they're still irritated. They're still irritated about just my riff on, you're going to have a whole bunch of equipment when you land on the ground. And then like, nope, it was all destroyed. You have nothing. You do want to avoid that standard character generation sequence, because the whole thing is going to get voided when you start the campaign. So that was a thing I at least avoided making a misstep on.
I remember, it reminds me very much of my high school time of running the D&D module Quagmire!
Right.
X6. Mm-hmm. And, you know, using my usual technique of like just trying to weave it into the gameplay of whatever campaign we were in, the first thing I needed to do is this lovely wilderness map of where the locations are, and there's this kind of archipelago of where the dungeons are. So they're going to have to get on board a ship and sail there, I suppose. I think there's maybe a hook in the adventure about like finding a message in a bottle or something like that.
Right.
My players spent so much time kidding out their ship to go check out Quagmire. And what do you know? Sure enough, in that adventure, first page one, the ship sinks. So I'm like, yep, it's going to sink. It's going to sink. But we are sure are spending a lot of time kitting out the ship in the sink.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I was very happy that I avoided that.
I think it's very clever trick that you played on your players there to tell them, to assure them, like, don't worry, you're going to get your equipment. It's coming.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's brilliant.
That was one of my better moves this time. Yeah. I'll say, you know, another thing I'll say is that you got to look careful for the expectations for experience. How you award experience points seem different in the rule book versus the adventures, because the rule book actually seems to say you should get, how the experience points work here is you're going to get one or two or three. You're probably going to get one or two or three experience points. And once they build up, you can buy new, you actually pay your experience points. So they go back down to zero, and you can either buy new skill levels, or you can just add them directly to your percentage ability scores, which I think is kind of elegant. And the rule book seems to say that you should get the one or two or three experience after every encounter, but the adventures are written assuming you get them after every nightly session. And that makes a big difference, because if you go by the book, you're only going to get like two experience points probably per night, if that. And the rule book would be maybe three or four times that rate. So when I ran it earlier, the advancement level was just a snail's pace, just painstakingly slow. And, you know, I'm only 13 and I'm kind of OCD, and I kind of just trust that the writers knew what they were doing. And, you know, now with the wisdom of my current situation, I could go, I'm not going to be entertained by that. I think my players are going to be slightly irritated about that. So I actually ignored the experience pacing of the adventures, and I use what's in the rule book. And I was like, you know, we're just going to do this one campaign, and then we're going to close the session. I'm not worried about burning through all the content, all the capacities. And over the 2 years, yes, I did have two players that did actually increase one of their ability scores up to 100. And I'm like, I'm okay with that. That's fine. Yep. It didn't break the game, and they could buy some skill levels, and they could kind of explore what the possibilities were. And that was another thing that I was happy that I did increase the rate of the experience as per the rule book. And again, I'm kind of surprised that they seem to be slightly out of sync on that point, but.
Was getting to 100% on a skill, did that break things? Was that
it did not.
Was it possible to fail?
Absolutely, yes. One of the things is no matter how the math works, you can't have more than 95% chance to do something. So there was, you always had to roll. There was always a small chance. I might be throwing a modifier at you. So like, this is really hard, minus 10, minus 20, minus 30. And then yep. The way that combat works is the base chance to hit something, it's half your dexterity plus some skill levels. So even if you had 100 dexterity, your beginning chance to hit is only 50. So I think it worked out perfectly fine.
Nice.
Okay. Yeah.
Tell me about, Dan, because I'm just looking at your pictures here, and you mentioned this earlier, tell me about the miniatures. How much miniature use did you end up using?
All the time. What a great question. And this was another thing that it took some, and it was something that I did up front. I did a lot of thinking about this up front and kind of a lot of analysis. And the picture we're looking at is the end result from the Dan's Old Time Minis program, where I was casting in my kitchen these miniatures one at a time for a couple months and then painting them. So again, the game comes out of the box expecting that you're going to use counters. It's very tactical in basis. Every single encounter has got a battle map. It assumes that you're doing that, and it's very visceral. It all looks great. Every time I look at the box of counters, I kind of want to, you know, get them in use again. And then as supplements, they came out with these miniatures, but the book doesn't really tell you how you're going to make use of them. I'm going to read the entirety in the rule book of what it says about using miniatures. This is the advanced rule book, page 3. Miniatures. Great. Instead of using counters, players can use small metal or plastic figures painted to look like their characters. These can be purchased in many toy and hobby stores. That's it. That's all you get.
That's
so
funny.
I did have to spend some time in advance thinking about, I can't use the battle maps because they're the wrong size. They're too small for these things to fit on. What scale should I use? Right, these rules don't have a fixed scale. That same page says you could a referee could map the inside of a building, use a map of 2 meters per square, or map a city using 5 meters per square, or the area around a city 25 meters per square. So that's kind of up in the air. And then a bunch of other stuff about what happens when people are moving around, you know, wind up, you have to adjudicate. So what I wound up deciding is for indoor, and I have a battle map that has squares on one side, hexes on the other. So for indoor stuff, I decided I'm going to use, or in a city with buildings, I'm going to use squares at a scale of 2 meters per square, which basically matches the scale of miniatures, which is nice. And coincidentally or not, matches how they've scaled most of the interior scenario spaces. So that seemed to work. Call that a double meter. Apparently, at one point, historically, people would call that that unit a double meter. So that's what I was saying at the table. Worked pretty well. And then for outdoor stuff, I was using a hex map with a scale of 5 meters per space that worked pretty well. I will say that some of our players had never seen a hex map before. And so even at the end, some of them were like, I don't know how to count. I'm having trouble counting my moves on the hex grid because this is the only time in their life they've ever actually seen that. and I wound up redrawing, like this is one of the things I didn't expect. I wound up redrawing all of the encounter settings to make sure that they fit on my battle map. So much for the time savings that I expected when I went into it.
Yeah. Fascinating.
But I was very happy with it. So I really like getting to use the miniatures. It was visceral. I mean, the rules are kind of sort of going to work with you more or less. But I did have to tweak a bunch of rules about how the miniatures worked on our table and get some gear, like a, you know, a ring for a grenade blast and things like that.
Yep. Yep. But generally, so generally then all four, you're using the miniatures and the, like, even regardless of indoor versus outdoor, you're generally using it, I take it, for tactical combat situations.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Every time a fight would break out, I'd have the battle map out every night. That's the first thing I'd put down. And as soon as a fight broke out, I'd usually mark stuff out, and put down the miniatures for that. Yeah.
Out of curiosity, with the difference of scale for the outdoors, did you just let them pile multiple miniatures into a hex, or is it just assumed that everybody spaces out and nobody gets within 15 meters of each other?
Great question. They kind of just naturally did that. I actually would say if you want to, you can fit multiple people in a space. And yeah, they wound up spacing themselves out, which kind of made tactical sense to avoid getting blown up from an enemy grenade.
Yep. Interesting.
Yeah. You know, two little accessories I did. So what I would do is on my screen, what I did is I had a couple of cards made up for particular scales. And so what I could do is I could just paperclip this on the outside of my screen and say, okay, we're currently operating at 2 meters per square, and the terrain isn't slowing you down at all. And so this is the number of spaces that you can walk or run depending on what race you are. And then if we've switched to a big outdoor space, you know, in the wilderness, then I could just flip this out and you could always see exactly how many spaces you can move in the current environment. So that worked pretty well. And if you were bogged down by sand or muck or something like that, then that would get folded in. So the players didn't have to do math there. And the other thing that worked really nice, as I've said before, is I just took all the math on my part. And the character sheets, in, you know, as opposed to D&D, you know, modern D&D, where the player is going to roll a die, have to look at a bonus on their sheet, have to add it and report it. I actually controlled all of that myself. And so I had a little minimalist sketch of the player abilities. And then before they took a shot or ran or something like that, I would just look at this index card. So I had this paper clipped on the inside of my screen. Here's all the player characters. Right. And I would remind myself about what miniature they use, whether it's the green Vrusk or the red human or whatever. Here's their base melee and ranged attacks. And then I just noted what their skills were, did a little piece of math in my head, plus all the situational modifiers like range. Are you running? Is it big? Is it not? And I could just do all the math myself and tell them you have a 45% chance to hit this shot. And they would roll the dice, and I think it was a really marvelous dynamic that they don't need me to tell them whether it worked. All the players can just look at the dice, read it like an oracle, and everybody knew whether it was a positive or negative result. And so when the whole campaign winds up at the end, there's a single die roll to see whether you win the war or lose the war. And I could just tell the players, you actually have achieved a 90% chance of this working. Who wants to roll the dice? Nobody wanted to roll the dice. the dice. And so what wound up happening is with the percentile dice, one player took the tens die and one player took the units die because nobody wanted full responsibility. And they rolled it and I didn't have to say anything. Just the whole table just erupted in cheers. And they you know, I wasn't going to cheat. I was out of my hands. I didn't have anything to say about it at that point. And so that was really nice that do all the math up front, tell them what the chance is. Everybody knows how a percentage works at this point, and they can just celebrate or despair. And it's on their side of the table. And I really, really like that mechanic by virtue of me taking over all the math.
You know, I see this dynamic in my quest game with what is ultimately the Wandering Monster role. I've rebranded it. I call it the Travel Die. And I say, you're traveling across the map and you're going here, you got to roll the Travel Die. You got to roll it once for every mile of terrain you're crossing. And they just know on a one or two of a, it's a big D6. We have a specific die for it. And it's a D6. And if you're on a one or two, something's going to happen along that leg of the journey. And oh man, they don't want to do it. They're constantly trying to add who's going to roll the die. I don't want to roll the die. You roll the travel die. All right, we'll take turns. Yeah, they do not want to be responsible for that thing.
That's great. That's great. I love the drama. Yeah. I love the tension.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good. Good. Good effect.
Super nice.
Yeah, I'll probably carry that forward in this campaign. That we, it so happens, it, our starting adventure was the battle or the Black Worm of Brandensford, which comes with an outdoor map that I just superimposed hexes on so I could quickly count distances.
Yes.
And works great. Works great.
There's a one of the when Volturna's campaign starts, one of my players said it's amusing that more or less you wind up doing dungeon play. So you're in the wilderness trying to survive in the desert without any advanced stuff, and then you wind up in, you know, I think what are called the tunnels of death or something like that. You wind up getting abandoned in a series of miles long tunnels that you have to reconnoiter and get out. So basically it's a large scale dungeon adventure to begin with, which is kind of funny.
That's funny.
And like you did with Brandenburg, you know, in the 80s, it's this teeny tiny little squares. It's this ridiculously cryptic set of mazy caverns with like a 30 by 40 set of squares that they expect you to carefully map and, you know, get confused and get wound around. And what I did is I redrew that to massively simplify it. And I turned the whole thing into kilometer sized hexes. So it's only like about a 6x7 map. And that was enough. It was all, it took us 3 sessions just to find their way through that simplified version of the maze. And it was confusing enough. But they could successfully map it. It wasn't completely unreasonable. I had to make my own hex map for that to make it workable to table.
That is super fun. So will you run it again, Dan? Will you run this adventure again? Will you run the system again? What's your feeling now?
I would love to do both. I mean, I really do like the system. And I will say that my house rules, you know, the number of house rules I was adding trended downward over time. It did stabilize. And it's at an equilibrium where I think we're all pretty happy with the system as slightly modified. That I should put that list of house rules online at some point. I love the adventure. I don't say wrapped up. And I was like, oh man, if I did this a third time, I could do a really, really good job.
Right. You know, there's something about systems that have an awesome adventure attached to it. Like, I guess I feel the same way about Warhammer Fantasy and The Enemy Within. I love playing Warhammer Fantasy RPG. I would play it without The Enemy Within, but oh my gosh, does The Enemy Within sing? And I would want, you know, and it's almost disappointing, right, when that campaign ends to go, oh, I don't get to. I feel like I've practiced. I want to do it again. I want to do it again because I've practiced and I know I'll be better at it the next time through.
I say the same thing about first edition D&D and the Giants Adventure. I think they're just tailor made one for the other to support that. And I really agree that people should think about campaign and game design together, because frankly, that is a real gold standard when those two things do work together like that.
Well, and it's interesting, right? That could have been a much simpler game if it was just built for that adventure. Like, you cut out a whole lot of rules, couldn't you?
Yes, I agree. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely,
just, just because Starship combat exists in the world doesn't mean you have to mechanize it if it's not going to be featured in the
It's a great lesson about that.
Dan, we are out of time. Do you have any final thoughts on Star Frontiers or your particular run of it? That's just a complete exciting conclusion.
I would recommend it. It really holds up, and I'll say that for my players who are now like around 30, they were pleasantly surprised that a game published in the early 1980s wasn't as cringy as they expected. They went into it, and particularly being thrown on, you know, they thought there was going to be a lot of really cringy, primitive, native type vibes in the game. And they were really delighted by how much they kind of frankly fell in love with each of the different alien races that are very different, have very different cultural personalities. As they got to meet each of them and engage and think about how they're different and things like that. And the alien races that the player characters are were really intriguing for everybody. So it really stands up. I think that the people that wrote the original Star Frontiers book and the original adventures really had some good stuff in their heart. And I like the system compared to modern systems. It's very simplified. I like introducing, you know, there was a moment in the 80s where everybody thought all game systems were all going to be percentile based. And I kind of like the opportunity to for you know, younger players to experience and think about that alternative history that could have possibly happened. And so you can just ignore all the later supplements. You can ignore the Zebulon's Guide that rewrote everything. You can ignore the later companies that thought that they could use the name of the game for something very, very different, very not nearly as attractive at all. But that original 1983 box set, you don't need the spaceship rules. There's a lot of really good stuff there, and it works with that initial adventure very, very well. With a couple little tweaks, it's one of my favorite adventure experiences. One of my favorite role playing experiences. I think it's really great.
Well, you'd certainly make it sound very enticing, Dan. I would, you know, I'd be eager to check it out myself someday. Sounds really fun.
Try it out. You might like it.
Viewers, if you have any thoughts on Star Frontiers, have you played it before? Do you agree, disagree on where it sings or where it doesn't? Leave us a message. Leave us a comment here in the YouTube video. We'd appreciate that. And possibly your thoughts will lead us to a new topic for another episode in the future.
Yeah, and remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us on Wandering DMs. We are on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all of the sites. So please look for us there and probe that like button.
If you prefer to listen to this show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those files are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. Also through various third-party carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those third-party sites and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
It really does. And of course, thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And like Paul said at the top of the hour, every tier gets you access to our private Discord server where people are conversing about all the stuff we love in role-playing games, D&D, fantasy, science fiction, Star Frontiers, horror, miniatures, model making, all that stuff. Great advice if you have a problem, ask there. And I'm sure that our patrons will have the best possible solution because that's what they're like. Now, Paul, next week, and we'll be there in about 10 minutes to continue the conversation or a live video after chat with our patrons, which we like so much. Now, Paul, next week we have a special guest scheduled. Remind me who that is.
Yeah, Chris M., a.k.a. Direct Sun, will be joining us, publisher of a variety of old school puzzle dungeons. This is something we touched on just actually in our last episode, the idea being how to incorporate puzzle solving into an old school adventure in ways that aren't just gimmicky, that don't just engage a single player, but actually formulate not just a single room or a single puzzle, but like form the entire dungeon itself becomes a puzzle. A lot of those concepts, really, really interesting stuff. I'm looking forward to it because I'm eager to adapt some of this content, frankly, over to Quest for my Quest game. And just very interesting to contemplate puzzles and what puzzles where their places in our classic gaming.
Nice. You know, in my Volturnus campaign, I was adding some other encounter areas and some ruins of like advanced technology and trying to make them into these puzzle mystery type places. And my design, I was like, I got there maybe about halfway there. So maybe on my next time, this is exactly advice I need to really flesh that out even more robustly. That's great. So we'll look forward to that. And everybody, don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.